Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, Beatles edition. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg. Hey, this is Ryan. Thank you so much for joining us for the Songs of Note podcast today. I am really excited to be talking about the Beatles. And so we're going to do something different here. We are going to do a full month of Beatles episodes. And pretty excited about the depth of conversations we're going to be going into with Colin Fleming. Every episode is going to be at least an hour. So these are going to be extended episodes. And this is all going to be working towards things that he'll be including in his book that he's writing. He's written a ton of articles. He's been featured in just tons of publications. And we kind of talked about this idea of, wouldn't it be cool to make an audio version, a podcast about some of those ideas he's going to be hitting on in his book. And the book that he's working on is going to be called Same Band You've Never Known, An Alternative Musical History of the Beatles. He's had a lot of people ask him to write that book, and he's ready to get it out. And so really excited to be talking with him about these different Beatles songs and time periods. And today we're hitting on a Beatles song called There's a Place, which you might not recognize that song. And so the history of it is, this is from their first album, and it's the song that is immediately before Twist and Shout on their first album. And it's really cool to talk with him about the arc of where they started to where they ended up just 4 years later, recording Sgt. Pepper, and just a really enjoyable conversation. And I learned a lot. As somebody who's a big Beatles fan, I learned a lot. So I hope you enjoy this interview. Here's my interview with Colin. Hey, this is Ryan here. I have Colin Fleming today, and we are talking about the Beatles. And Colin knows more about the Beatles than anyone I know. And anyone I know says that I know the most about the Beatles. And my Beatles knowledge doesn't touch Colin. So, Colin, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about the Beatles.
My pleasure. It's time for edification, my friend.
Yes, yes. Okay, so you've written a number of articles on the Beatles. You've had a lot of people kind of asking you, when are you going to put out a Beatles book? And so you have started working on a book, and it's going to be called Same Band You've Never Known, An Alternative Musical History of the Beatles. And what we're going to be hitting on is over the next four episodes, we're going to be hitting on things that you are going to be writing about in that book. And today we're starting with some of the early stuff. So, man, I'm honored that you wanted to talk about it on the podcast. And I'm like kind of nerding out because I haven't stopped listening to the band the past week in preparation for this show. So thank you for being willing to come on and talk about that.
Sure, my pleasure.
Okay, so let's talk about early Beatles. Let's talk about, for people who don't know the Beatles, like when you hear this song, the song that we're kind of anchoring this episode on is the Beatles song There's a Place. And for me, when I listened to it, when it first started, I always think it's going to be Love Me Do, because it has a similar feel, similar sound, harmonica, and then it kicks into this other song that's totally different. But for people that don't know the Beatles, you know, that it's been said, who's it, Malcolm Gladwell talks about, you have to have 10,000 hours doing something before you are an expert at it. And he even referenced the Beatles in one of his books. For people who don't know the backstory on the Beatles, like when you hear this first album, they sound fully realized. You have John and Paul, you have the harmonies, the songwriting is still coming together, but it's brilliant. And so there was a lot of work that went into that moment in the studio in 1963, I think, is when they recorded the Please Please Me album. Can you talk a little bit about the lead into their practice, their performances, Hamburg, any of that kind of stuff for the beginning of the Beatles?
Well, first of all, I would step away from the Gladwell, because I don't think he knows the first thing about what he's talking about. It's all well and good to say 10,000 hours will add up to this, but it's really not like that, because you have to enter this world in the first place with something that other people are just not going to have, which no amount of hours can cover for. I think what he does is he takes complex minds belonging to other people, not his, and he reduces it to this kind of softball intellectual speak. So people with more of an interest in how they come across to others with these pull quotes they can use rather than what they actually know are going to be Gladwell people. So I think he's actually done the Beatles a disservice. I would say that the Please Me album isn't so much the Beatles as they were fully realized as they were capable of being fully impactful, because there are gaps in this record, which was cut in February in one session lasting 585 minutes, excepting some of the singles. But for the most part, the album itself was just done as an in-concert recording in the studio. And you mentioned maybe one flaw, where you have the harmonica of Love Me Do, and you think that that's the place, that there's a place it's going to go to, right, when it has the harmonica on the finished version. It's very Bruce Chanel, who had that song, Hey Baby. You hear it at football games now, right? Hey Baby, mm-hmm. And it's all that harmonica riff. So they were patching things together. They were repeating themselves somewhat, and they didn't know how long they were going to last. But what always struck me about this song, There's a Place, and why it's so prominent in this book I'm doing, is there is nothing that could have prepared you for this song in 1963, especially if you were an English rock band. In fact, I would say that there was nothing that could have prepared Paul McCartney for when John Lennon said to him, I have this song. It's a bit different than what we've been doing.
That's
called
cool.
There's a Place.
Man, and like when I listen to it, it's one of those that shocks me when you hear the whole album. The album as a whole, this is one that jumps out, and it's like, man, the harmonies on it are just incredible. Talk about harmony. Are you a musician? Do you play an instrument?
I don't formally play an instrument, no.
Okay, so I played guitar in a band. I sang really bad harmonies. I sang bad backgrounds. It was really hard for me to sing harmony, even with in-ear monitors, with the mix cranked up. In this song, gosh, the harmonies from the first, from the get-go, it's incredible. Talk about how unique is the Lennon-McCartney harmony that they are able to create. I mean, it's so rare.
There's a lot happening here. One of the hallmarks of their harmony is that when they're really on, you don't even know who's singing the harmony.
Yeah.
Like, you don't know who's doing the lead vocal, and you don't know who's doing the harmony. That's how their voices dovetail together. And on this session, it's audible right on the official track, let alone all of the outtakes that we're going into. But Lennon's voice is, he can't hit certain notes. So this is going to play both as a strength and really this weakness to be overcome. And we're going to hear both in this song. But in the harmony in this song, you have this tune where you have traditional lyrics, like what you'd get from teeny bopper songs, where there's low and blue and mind and all that kind of stuff. But this idea of retreating into the mind is not something you get in pop in 1963. You get it in 1967. You get it with like Strawberry Fields Forever. But note when they come to the word mind and they harmonize on that, it sounds, and it's not them overdubbing themselves, it sounds like how many voices at once, these two guys. Look how wide that sound is. It's like 16 voices, right?
Mm-hmm.
You'd think that they're just double tracking themselves and then overdubbing and overdubbing and overdubbing. And then after that, they're going to also hit that word time really strong. And it's fascinating to me because they hit the first word, mind, with more force. There's more volume on that word than there is in time. So there's like this emphasis on this interiority, this internal component. And you get that feeling. You get the sound equaling the sense through that harmony vocal and how hard it hits on that single word. It's the kind of text painting that is. Handel is someone who could hear that and be like, oh yeah, I worked some of that into my Messiah when I was just using one word and burnishing it all these different ways. That's what they're doing. They're burnishing that word via the harmony as they sing it.
And they're putting special emphasis on mind, because that's the place where they are saying, there's a place that I go in my mind. Like when I first, when you casually hear this song, it's like, oh yeah, where's the place they're going? Is it somewhere physical? And then you're pointing out, no, this is actually kind of out there a little bit for the time, especially like content wise, for him to be saying, no, I'm going somewhere mentally, right?
It's crazy. It would almost be seen as soft. It would have been seen as soft. These were supposed to be hard guys, men of machismo or young men of machismo. And here you have a guy saying, I have some struggles going on every now and again, and this place I go to is my mind. Then you have this almost Merseyside cone, and there's no time when I'm alone. Meaning you've rid yourself of this problem of being on this clock. You have this complete mental freedom, but the way that that line is sung, that's just me reading it back, but you don't hear it that way when it's sung, right? Because it's cleaved into two parts. You never enjam them. You don't connect them, really, and there's no time. And then you get this lacuna, this rest. And the fascinating thing about this song, or one of them, is that you have something you shouldn't have. You have audible rest, where they're resting on a word, and yet it should be silent, but there's this sound. It reminds me of, a lot of people don't know this, but the beginning of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. The actual first thing that you hear is something you don't hear. There is a rest built into the score before that famous downbeat. And we're going to have four downbeats from Ringo Starr in this song that power into the bridge, but it's doing something with audible rest that was incredibly sophisticated, even though you have elements of the Moon and June type of lyric, but nobody was doing this. Dylan hadn't gotten around to this type of thing. The Everly Brothers, maybe, with All I Have to Do Is Dream, it went to a similar headspace. And also with both of those songs, you have men in groups with other men, and there's this masturbatory element, because I'm not going off on my own. I have this kind of dominion. I have this sort of power of self-love. And this would have been the type of music that I feel guys, especially at this time, could only make together if they shared a kind of fealty and a kind of love.
And you definitely, I feel like you definitely feel that in the gosh, just how they follow the harmony so close. It's like it sounds like the same voice, like you said. And I even read that Paul McCartney talked about how people have a hard time telling who's singing lead on this part in the same song. They would switch between one singing lead and one singing the harmony within the same song, which is not typical. Typically, it would be one lead through the whole thing, but they switch in here. And even as somebody who's listened to the Beatles so much, I'm like, who is that? Which guy is singing that one? Which I love how they do that on the song.
They do that in the early days, not a lot, but it's not infrequent. And you get these songs where it's maybe 55% Lennon. That's what the number's normally going to be when they do this kind of venture early on. 55% Lennon on the lead, 45% McCartney. Like, they're both singing lead at the same time, but Lennon singing a little extra lead. Do you know what I mean?
That's
what you get on She Loves You. They're both singing it. If you watch a video of She Loves You from Ed Sullivan or whatnot, or the Washington Coliseum a year after this recording that we're talking about, they both look like they're singing full-throated lead,
right?
But they're not. McCartney's able to hang back a bit. McCartney really pulls this band together a lot of times. He makes Harrison sound like a better guitarist, even on these Please Please Me recordings, where it's not like the bass was featured prominently, but if you took out the bass on these songs, you would have, and this is a nice little bass riff that's happening on There's a Place as well, this little two-note thing that he's doing constantly, you take that out and it's going to sound gappy, tinny, because Harrison could be pretty tinny, and if you listen to the outtakes, before they said, we need the harmonica, which really transforms the song, to beef up this music, Harrison, it's interesting because he has this tone on this song. He doesn't solo, of course, but it's a precursor, guitar tone-wise, to Nowhere Man. It has that kind of chording. It has that kind of coloration. If I said to you, think of a color of the guitar in Nowhere Man, you're going to think of like a yellow, like a citron, right? It's that kind of polished gold. This has that polished gold going for it. He doesn't have the chops that he's going to have in 2 or 3 years, but you take away the bass and he's exposed somewhat. You take away the harmonica. Starr is doing this very regimented beat, which you would get from these Merseyside bands, Jerry and the Pacemakers. It's like their default beat. It's almost like this military beat, except it happens to be in 4/4 time. And you come to the end of the song, and he's like liberated by the end. He starts dropping what old swing drummers in the 1930s called bombs. Starts doing these crazy fills, like this proto Rain that you wouldn't expect him to be doing, because everyone is caught up and this internal moment of complicity, really.
Man, and it's so good. And you know, you're actually the first one that I heard say this was their first serious piece of art. I mean, really, this is their first expression of something that was unique to them. And why do you think that this is the first song that really counts as that for them?
I think it's their first mature song, because the subject matter went to a place that other songs did not go to. Even Tin Pan Alley and those genius songwriters, they were doing Moon and June themselves, but they were doing Moon and June with fantastic wit and Joycean puns, and the Beatles couldn't get to that yet. They were not sort of wordsmiths at that level. And also, they hadn't stepped out far enough to do that. Where they stepped out usually was with their chords. That's when Dylan heard them and said, what are you up to, fellows? Mm. You can't be doing this, because people could say that they didn't know the rules. Joy Division was the same way. We've talked about them. It's like, oh, how can there be anything between Joy Division and the Beatles? Because there was no edge of the table where the envelope could be pushed too far and fall over. It was just, okay, the planar field keeps continuing. Let's keep pushing. But they knew with the lyrics that you had to rein that in, or they thought that that had to be reined in, because that's what everybody was doing. So the breakthrough here was this localization of the mind. And it's a Proustian song almost, because you have this discovery, and maybe it was an accidental discovery. There's no time when I'm alone. The mind is such that, for instance, I do a lot of things in my mind that allow me to do things outside in the world that I shouldn't be able to do. So yesterday I'm out there and I'm walking 20 miles or whatever. I can, in theory, write 15 stories in my head in that time. I couldn't write them physically out sitting at the computer. You couldn't even type that fast. But there's nothing to say that you can't, in a second in your mind, come up with 150,000 things. Hmm. You're not governed by the same time that you are externally. And that's a very heady concept. And it was a concept that, for me as an artist, was liberating. And other artists like the Beatles have had that relationship with time, or their version of that relationship with time. So here they are first grasping that, or Lennon is grasping that. And it makes sense that he would get to it first. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think there's a level of sagacity in this song, accidentally discovered or not. But once they found it, they thought, hey, that's a place, that's a mine that we can work for a while.
And it was. And they took it to so many different places throughout the 60s that to me still makes their lyrics so interesting. And they're not like specific enough in the way that only they could relate to it. You know, that we've talked about how they would write in a way that's universal, so that, you know, you and I can still relate completely to the songs that they're talking about that were written so many years ago. You talked about the transition chords and some of those unique chords. I remember reading this story about how, who was it? I think, I don't remember which one it was, if it was Paul and George or if it was John and George, but a couple of them heard about a guy across town that knew how to play like a B7, and so like chord. So they hopped on a bus and they went across town to learn the chord. And that's so wild. And, you know, today's age where I can Google anything, but there's less buy-in. Like, think about how much that chord meant to them, you know? Like, after they learned it, man, we worked for that. And then they add those seventh chords so many times into their songs, and it adds such a level of complexity and interest. It makes it so much more interesting to me from their songs. And something else that came to mind is Elliott Smith is one of my favorite songwriters, and I remember him saying, one of the things that he loved about the Beatles the most were those transition chords that you kind of talked about that Bob Dylan referenced. He thought the most interesting thing was that they took so much care in the in-between moments, which you hear on so many Beatles songs, and it does. It makes them more interesting to listen to every time, for sure.
Life is lacuna. Life is what happens in between things. We look at something, it's like, this is my big day today, this is the event. But really, it's the in-between events that are going to inform your life, how you think, all of that. It's not like this big set piece, and I think we tend to view life that way. And you have these moments in this song The chords are like these precipice chords to my thinking. If you think about Don't Let Me Down, and right at the end of their career, and Lennon beseeches Starr to give him the courage to come crashing in, right? He hangs. He vocally levitates. You know what I mean? Before he comes in with that don't let... They're doing that in this song. They're hanging up in the air on those kind of levity chords, right? Before they come crashing in. And so he's doing the same thing. And this is kind of the point of my book, because we turn to things like She Loves You, or Sgt. Pepper, Strawberry Fields Forever. And those are the go-to moments that make the artist what the artist is. But I think the better you are at making art, it's the day in, day out moments. Mm-hmm. The moments that you think of as incidental, that gig you played to 58 people that someone happened to record that you didn't think twice about, this B-side that you wrote, this air shot that you did that was recorded off of the radio, this demo you cut late at night in your home studio. For me, it's maybe something I happen to write on the blog that is just something I'm writing on a blog. But you see what I'm saying? It naturally comes out. If I send you this formal story or you buy a book of mine, you see he's always the same. He doesn't leave off. He doesn't have these official moments of, okay, here's the proper art. And no one looks at that with the Beatles. And so I think one of the first places to look is there's a place. Look at this record. What do people look at? Please Please Me, of course. Twist and Shout. How could you not look at that? I saw her standing there, which you hear all the time. It's a great piece of writing. She was just 17, never been the beauty queen, and then one of them says to the other, "Nah, don't do that. She was just 17, if you know what I mean." It's porn. That's dirty. Yeah, everyone knows what that means. It's like, yeah, I'm going to get a shot, and I am not going to die. That's going to be fun. Everyone knows what that means.
Right.
And so you had that sophistication of the writing in these moments where it's not really the official art. I want to hold your hand is the official art, that kind of thing. But this stuff really tells a story, and a more emblematic story, in my view, of who these people were as artists who impact your life.
That's really well said. And I think that's true for art. And I think it for me, you know, when I latch onto a band, a lot of times it is those demo, like you said, or the B-sides or whatever it is that makes you hear something more than what you heard even on the original recording. So like you're talking about some of the bootlegs of this song in this session, which for people listening, there's actually a really awesome official release now. It's called the Beatles Bootleg Recordings. And you can listen to the outtakes from this session and others. And it's so cool to hear just the banter between the band, to hear the stops, to hear like, you know, Paul McCartney's like, why'd you stop? And they are just trying to figure this stuff out. But hearing them work it out to get to the place of excellence for the final recording, to me, it's as enjoyable, if not more, in many instances.
We have to think of this entire album. And so there's a place as well. It sounds strange, but it's a live album. It just happens to be in the studio. And it's a live album where it's like a workshop. Maybe if you're in a band, you have a friend, some friends, your friends come out to some party and you're going to play new songs and you're not quite getting a song the way you want it to go. Or someone in the audience, when your buddy says to take it faster and you do it again, right? Like you're workshopping in front of people. The Who did that before they had figured out who's next, when they had Lifehouse and they're going to this theater in London and they're just going through these takes of this song and for people who are there. So the Beatles are essentially workshopping this album live. This is what you would have heard two nights before when you went out to see them at some club. This is still the pre-fame era. They've had Love Me Do from October of the year before. We're in the winter of 1963. But they're going to go through these songs, and they're on the clock. They have to move with alacrity. And this is where Ringo Starr was a big help. Because if you listen to those outtakes that you mentioned, and you can get them on, I got them originally on like Ultra Rare Tracks, Unsurpassed Masters, nice. The Purple Chick stuff to me is still the best go-to for that. But Starr, who is sort of in the band, and he was on the fence in terms of George Martin, like, are you going to be able to use this guy in the studio?
Right,
he didn't want to, and Starr had to prove himself. start allows them to move with pace. When they have a breakdown and there's a place and they have to ramp up again, his drumming, he doesn't screw up. In fact, if you go through the 7 years of studio recordings, they screw up a lot. It is very rarely Ringo Starr who screws up. And it's not because what he was playing was so simple. But he was that up-tempo offense, the quarterback, okay, just calling the play at the line of scrimmage. He's very underrated that way. And I think that they knew, as having him in that fashion, that they could take some extra chances on a vocal when a song was going well and maybe try to push it a little bit further. And if that didn't work, they were going to find the groove. They were very good at locking into a groove during this 1963 era, thanks to Starr. So you have this live album, and no one ever says, I kind of do, it's one of the best live albums ever. But it is, even though it's not a live album.
Right.
Again, though, is that idea of the audible rest. It's the idea of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony beginning with silence. Before dun 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 dun, and here you have this idea of the live album that's not a live album.
And you know, for people listening who maybe aren't familiar with how studio recording works now, and how it worked later in the Beatles' career, like the way that it was, you know, now you can plug in your house, or if you go to a studio, you're gonna have a guitar player in one room, and you're gonna try the take 50 times, and the vocalist is gonna try it as many times as you want. And when you say this is a live album, this is four guys in a studio paying for time. They have one day. George Martin hits record, and then they are just going to go bam, 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 and do it. And there's hardly any overdubs on the performance. Isn't that right?
Well, Lennon's sick. He's you can hear his voice cracks.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, what's that episode of the Brady Bunch? It's not to that degree. You know the one I'm talking about. Is it Bobby?
Yeah, I think so.
Is it Peter? Whatever one it is.
I don't know, but I know the one. Yeah.
And his voice, it cracks throughout, even the finished version of There's a Place. Now, this same album has the greatest vocal in rock and roll history.
Twisted
and that's
out.
Going to be on the song that There's a Place sets up. There's a Place sets up Twist and Shout. Like, this is the one sets up I Am the Resurrection on the Stone Roses debut. Mm. And the reason Lennon can sing Twist and Shout like he does, he's sick. It's not a nuanced vocal. You're just screaming. If you're sick, you have a head cold. You can sort of scream your way through it. What you can't do is sing the beginning of If I Fell and not sound like a buffoon.
Right.
So his voice cracks and There's a Place. They just keep carrying on. Think about that. You show up, like, okay, you've had this single, Love Me Do. It reached number 17. We've invested a little bit money in you. Although George Martin never wanted them. He was hooking up a friend with a favor as it came out.
Man,
there wasn't some like story where they charmed him. It's like, oh, I don't like your tie. That was said to him, but he had already been forced into signing this group he didn't want. So that's like apocryphal.
Uh-huh.
And so they're there, and the guy shows up, and he's sick. What would happen any other time? You say, okay, we'll just reschedule it.
Cancel.
Like, nah. It's like, you guys suck. We're just doing it. Like, you're here. Like, you came down in the van with Mal and Neil.
Right.
We're doing. Have a lozenge, dude.
Yeah.
and then not only are you sick, we're going to do this for 585 minutes. But before we do Twist and Shout, because we have to figure out what song we're going to do, we will go to like a restaurant and get some tea.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then like kind of plan what this last move is going to be. But think about that sort of that juxtaposition, because you'd think this highly introspective song, which is what it is not going to be able to set up a song about. Lennon said he liked Twist and Shout for the same reason he liked rock and roll. It was about sex. Twist and Shout is a euphemism. It's not for like twisting and shouting with your volume of Flaubert, right? We all know what Twist and Shout means. It's like sexual contortion of positions. It's just free-for-all satricon. And you wouldn't think that the two songs could be, or There's a Place could be this door that opens you up to this world, this free-for-all world of Twist and Shout. But they have elements, sonic elements in common. Think about the bombs that Ringo Starr drops later on in Twist and Shout. He does the same thing with a different tone that he does on There's a Place. Harrison's guitar tone is very similar. And it's not because it was similar in every song on the album.
Yeah.
It's not the same at all, and I saw her standing there. He doesn't have that ringing electricity, that Nowhere Man sound that we talked about. So there's all of this going on at once, and they just leave in this, okay, you're sick, we'll put that in. It's covered up on the harmony vocals that we talked about. And the harmony vocals, this was mono when they were doing it. I can't get over how resplendent they sound, because this is going to be, it's like two tracks.
It is.
And then they have to use a track further for the harmonica, because they're not doing the harmonica in real time on this particular performance. You have the guitar, and the guitar isn't beefy enough, so they have to put in that harmonica, which we mentioned Bruce Chanel in that big hit, but I think the harmonica owes more of a debt to Little Walter. He was a Chicago bluesman who played harmonica like it was a tenor saxophone. So I'd mentioned to you Little Willie John and his voice the other day, and how he sang like his voice was a tenor saxophone. That's the harmonica sound that they're going for. And it carries like the entire bottom of the tune along with that bass. Yeah.
Totally. And it does fill it out. It gives it that interesting middle layer that just thickens up the track.
But I think there's this bell-like quality, right? Like a church bell to the song. Its timbre is that of a church bell. It rings. So many parts of this song ring, from the harmonica. It's not like this bluesy, funky swamp harmonica.
Right.
It's like this clarion sounding call to arms out of the Bible type of harmonica. It's very sheeny. It's very bright. So is the guitar tone.
Yep.
And then you have that harmony vocal. It's, again, it's radiant. What do you say? It's like a radiant vocal. When they hit those words, home and alone, it's like this cornucopia of audible gems coming out of your stereo at you. Really,
it's so when you hear them hit those notes. I mean, my mind like does colors when I'm trying to picture off like who's singing what and what notes they're getting to, because it just goes in and out, and it's so beautiful. Radiant is a great way to describe it. Man, I would give anything to have been at that diner. You mentioned this in passing, but when right before they recorded Twist and Shout, how the band took a break and they were like, what are we going to do? We got one more song. And John's saying, I can't do it. And they're like, we got to do it. And he did what? I think they did two takes of Twist and Shout. And he went all in on the first one and blew his voice out and couldn't do a second one. Wasn't that right?
Right. If you listen to it with headphones on and you turn it up really loud, you can actually hear this gurgling sounds, the blood in the back of his throat, because he did cut up his larynx when he sings it. And yeah. And if you listen to the live versions of it too, like on the 1964 tour, they were a lot better live on those concerts than people say, especially with the handicaps that they were facing. They couldn't really hear themselves. It's not like today, like the foldback speakers and everything. It wasn't like that. It was just kind of you plugging up your ears and trying to sing the best you could, right? It's a difficult thing to do. And they would just do these cursory versions of Twist and Shout on those shows. They did a version of it in Sweden in October of 1963, so later this same year, which I had written about for Rolling Stone as their, or rather the Atlantic, as their best ever concert, where they did both Money and Twist and Shout, which is not something that you couldn't go to that well too often because of the vocal strain. And Lennon goes for it there. And there's a version on the BBC in 1963 that did lots of versions, but there's one in particular where he goes for it, where it's the last program they're doing of this episode of the series that they really liked, and they actually kind of bid each other farewell. They bid farewell to the host, and they dedicate, John says, I'm doing this one for Paul, George, and Ringo, and they all kind of dedicate the song to each other. It's a sweet moment. And then Lennon, I guess he's moved, he's pumped up, he goes for it. But, yeah, so they're sitting there, they're having the tea, and they know that there's going to be one opportunity to do this song. You can hear them do it at the Star Club from December of the year before. And that's actually what the first chapter in this book of mine is about, is that the best recordings for that Beatles spirit that you can get, that all-out rock and roll, is from the Star Club. And if you just read the history books on the Star Club, it's like, these recordings suck. You don't need to listen to this. It's like, yeah, you absolutely need to listen to that. And they go for it there. But they're also playing in front of these drunken sailors, and they don't really want to be there, and they want to be back in England, and sure, it's Christmas, and they're drunk and they're still putting in a solid performance and they're cutting loose, but it's not the same as going for the glory of people are actually going to hear this and rehear this throughout the north of England, which is all they were thinking at the time.
Yeah. And so when we talk about even like this specific studio session being, you know, all day, you've got to have a lot of chops, a lot of time of practicing, playing live like they did. I mean, they were together for years playing, you know, hundreds of shows, practicing, honing in on these skills, their sessions, to be able to muster all that into this one marathon session. I mean, talk about the devotion or the, not devotion, but dedication to your craft of all those shows, the lead up, the plan, to get to the point where you can execute these songs at this level of musicianship in a day. I just think that's phenomenal.
I actually don't look at it that way. I look at them as becoming hard workers from this point going forward. Their schedule throughout 1963. Don't forget, Ringo Starr has only been in the band since August of 62. So in a way, they haven't been together that long. The other three have been together for a while. But it's a different dynamic when you have a drummer. A drummer can make or break a band. Oh, they had been with Pete Best for all of these years. And for quite a while, it was just like Lennon and McCartney, really. They rated Harrison not even as this junior partner. It's just these two guys doing these Everly Brother homages. And that's where they figured out at Frothin Avenue, McCartney's parents' home or his dad's home at that point, his mother was gone, how their voices could work in harmony. Mm-hmm. So they had that locked up. It's like, I remember when in hockey, when like the Stastny brothers defected from Europe, these three brothers, and like they were going to join the team, they were going to play together and they were going to be dynamic and electric. And you already had this built in component because this skill set came together. So that's how that was introduced into the Beatles. They already had this particular thing, but you didn't know how it was going to go with the drummer, where they're really working hard because they'd had these engagements in Hamburg, sure, and they would have these quasi all-nighters. They'd play for like a while. But you just look at what they were doing in 63, they're in the studio. It's like every day. They're in the studio, they're playing a concert, they're doing all of these BBC sessions. I would argue that they became the writers they ultimately were on the BBC. In fact, I wrote a big feature about that for The Atlantic, where they are integrating parts of songs by other people. And they're playing live, they're fielding requests, and they're writing on the go. They're saying, okay, we can take some of this, we can morph it into this thing that we do, and they're blending. They're this musical Cuisinart, really, and they're figuring out their own writing ability. Because when we started talking about Gladwell, a lot of that was about how they played together as a unit. And the thing about the Beatles is, and this sounds like sacrilege, but I really believe it's true, how they played as a unit is in some ways irrelevant. What was germane was what they wrote. It's the songs, right? It happens to be this band that could execute the songs. Some people thought they weren't so good at executing the songs. Pete Townsend thought they were a horrible band as players.
Right.
And if you were Pete Townsend and you listened to early George Harrison, you can kind of see why he'd think that, right?
Totally.
I don't think that. But totally it is like, it's if you listen to the outtakes of There's a Place, and Harrison's trying to play the intro, and there's no harmonica to help him out.
It's a little rough.
It's dun, 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 dun. Like, it's very tinny, right? It sounds like he has a rubber band. And that's what Lennon joked with him another time when they were trying to do One After 909 in March of the same year. He says, what kind of solo was that? And he compares it to, again, this rubber band at one point. Like, okay, yeah, this doesn't feel so great. But it was the songs. And they're just now in this at this point, because a lot of these songs in this first album are covers, they're figuring out how to write the songs.
Yeah.
And that's going to happen over that blistering pace of 63. When McCartney said, God bless us, we worked our English arses off, he's talking about 63, really, because the pace is brutal.
Right.
And then they become this band that you could not anticipate. You could anticipate I Saw Her Standing There if you knew them in 1962. But this band that's going to be writing these chords of A Hard Day's Night and If I Fell and all of that stuff, the maturity of the second side of the A Hard Day's Night album, that's all going to be coming with how they're working going forward as they get the taste of fame and they know that they're reaching people.
Well, and you hit on this when we had talked in an earlier podcast episode about the Beatles, and I think I had asked, was the band the best at capturing a moment of a specific part in a track? And you made the comparison to many, many years ago when people would deliver the orations. It wasn't the delivery that lasted, it was the words that lasted. And I think that's an interesting look at the Beatles, and you don't hear that. You don't hear people say it's the songs that mattered in the live performance, or the four individuals performing the parts did not matter as much as the songs themselves, which I think is what you're saying, right?
They are. I mean, don't get me wrong. If you just want to have like a cutting contest, like Battle of the Bands, they're going to kick everyone's ass. Mm-hmm. Like, but they're not musicians that like the John Coltrane Quartet couldn't just destroy them type of thing. It's going to be the songs, and it's going to be crucially the thing that they were best at was the vocal component of the songs.
Yeah.
You have two of the best singers in the entire medium. I mean, you probably have two of the three. Like, who else is it going to be? Like, Elvis? I mean, right. McCartney, right. Lennon, and Elvis are, like, ordered however you want. But that's going to be three. But it's not just that you had two in one band. Like, that's formidable. That's nice.
Yep.
You had two singers with styles that didn't overlap.
Yeah.
But meshed,
mm-hmm.
and that's when they, so they're sitting in the bathroom and they're playing in 1960 over at like McCartney's house, and they're not going to school and truancy and all of this, and that's when they're using the echo of the bathroom. And they must have realized like, huh, we have a secret weapon here.
Oh,
this
man.
Is a unique weapon. Like people like you're like whatever it is, for whatever reason, whatever put us here, God, the fates. Dumb luck that we live a mile and a half away from each other and our voices go together like this. I mean, that's like,
as the English
say, that's like, yeah, it's like over egging the pudding. It's like, mm-hmm. here you go. And then they still had to find their way, and they had to find people who were foils for them, and they had to find people who abetted what they wanted to do and could help them out with a song or two like Harrison could and would be largely docile to the wishes of the two main guys, and you had to be okay with them pulling rank on you, but you also had to be along with this grueling, fast-paced ride of 63, and that's when they became, you challenge people, it's like, I mean, I ran 3 miles today, it's like, it's not a big deal. If I was on a team, I barely ran 3 miles, and you have this no other option but to run 10 miles
mm-hmm.
because everyone's doing it. You either can't do it at all, or you find out that you're someone who, hey, I can do 12.
Right.
And the more they got pushed, the more they got into it, because these guys were competitive MFers,
mm-hmm.
and that's not how art is right now. It's supposed to be like kumbaya, and we're all these literary citizens. They wanted to stick the knife in your throat and show you how much better they were than you. I mean, I love it. It pumps me up right now.
Totally.
But that's where they were coming from.
Totally. And like, it made the art better, because the other one was like, I'll show you. What's this? You wrote Strawberry Fields. I'll write Penny Lane. You know?
It goes against the grain of like our society right now. Right? And you mentioned before that they're on this bus. And they actually had a lot of moments on buses, because like George Harrison, father was a bus driver, was like auditioned on a bus.
Yeah, that's
right.
The buses
were a Cree component. Penny Lane, the roundabout. Someone could write some recondite theory on the Beatles and like public transportation. Maybe they'll get that idea from this podcast. But yeah, they had to go across town. And now with everything in front of us, look, there are people out there who love the Beatles. And when you mention these outtakes, that's going to be news. I'm not knocking anybody, but that's going to be news to a lot of people. And these were things that you could listen to anytime you wanted. I mean, you had to go and hunt them back in the day, but they've always been on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're not like tech savvy, it's just typing in, like, it's working the Google, really. And people, they're not wired that way now. And we facilitate that. It's like, no, let's not compete, and we'll take care of you. And we get this very, This it's not a meritocracy. Merit is rare now. But for the Beatles, they were almost like they were athletes. Like, if you're an athlete, if you're a basketball player, and you're the best, you're eventually going to have your chance because it's a meritocracy.
Right.
It wasn't like an out-and-out meritocracy, the music industry at the time. But if you could write and you could sing and you could play and you could create a tune that could be a hit, you're going to have your chance. Hmm. And that was something that they became, I don't want to say too competitive, but like a Michael Jordan, they were even more competitive.
Right.
And Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys would do this, or Dylan would do whatever. So this is like Chekhov and Gogol going at it. This isn't like Chekhov and some fool in an MFA program in Iowa. These are the big boys hitting the big boys.
Mm-hmm.
And it's someone saying, oh, yeah, you did that Pet Sounds thing. I see. I must raise my game, sir. And then just gauntlet, ding, on the ground, rattling around. And someone else would pick it up. And they, there's a wonderful story where Mick Jagger, he's all excited. And the Stones have done, they've done, like, Beggar's Banquet, and they're having a party, and all their friends are there, and they're like, yeah, listen to our Beggar's Banquet. It's just playing over and over again, and Paul McCartney shows up, and he has an acetate. He's like, oh, no, it's our new one. Why don't you play this for a little bit? And Jagger puts it on, and it's like, hey, Jude. And everyone's like, oh, wow, this is the best thing ever. The McCartney's like, I have to go. And he just leaves.
Literally dropped the mic and dropped a bomb.
Yeah,
and
he gives them. He's like, you can keep the acetate. I mean, because they fall apart eventually anyway. But he's like, here you go. This is our new little one. And then he just goes.
I love hearing in the interview that I don't remember where this was, the anthology or something. But McCartney's quote was, "We were a good little band." Like the ultimate way to say he means
that a certain way though.
Mm.
What he means by that is when you take away, you strip away the hits and the millions of records sold and the fame and the Maharishi, all that stuff. When you just boil it down to what every band in its heart ultimately is, every single band there's ever been is ultimately in its heart a unit on a stage making music together that works or it doesn't work.
That's
what he's talking about.
Yeah.
And he's saying even it sounds like a remark of humility, but to me it's a remark of an existential truth.
Hmm.
Because he's saying this is what we were on a stage as people who came together to make music. We clicked. We hit it. We went to that spot, that sort of locus of truth of performance. That's what he's talking about. We were as much a band has ever been.
That's
just, you strip everything back to just, there's been a flood and it's like this Edenic time and there's a stage and everyone gets to have their go on the stage. We will win the battle of the bands. We were a band that just, the bass was in the right place. The drummer did the right thing. The harmony vocal came in where it could. The solo, we were tight coming out of those breaks. That's what he meant. And he said, as if to say, don't lose sight of that. It's not just 20 million copies of whatever the record was, She Loves You.
Mm-hmm.
It was this. We were a band. Just like you guys in your garage. You said, fuck, you're a band. You were better on Saturday night than you were on Friday night. He was saying that we had the same thing.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a kind of connection and awareness that at the time the Beatles were doing what they were doing, but no one thought of them as a band. People thought of them as this concept or this phenomenon or this spirit that captured the spirit of the times, like a spirit in housing a spirit, and they had good timing, but they were just a kick-ass little rock and roll unit too.
Oh man, they were so good. I mean, that's an understatement of the year. But talk about, you know, we talked about Strawberry Fields briefly there for a minute. And to me, Strawberry Fields, and there's a couple songs that the Beatles put out that feel so personal. And you kind of compared Strawberry Fields and And My Life. You made a comparison to There's a Place. What's the similarity between those three songs for you that makes those kind of ring as something that connects those three songs?
I look at There's a Place as a melding of psychedelia and interiority. And you can say, wait, you couldn't have had psychedelia and psychedelic music in 1963. That's not really going to happen at all until the end of 65 and 66 and then certainly 67. But that presupposes you couldn't have a psychedelic song if you're not on psychedelics. And I don't think that's true because it's an oral, A-U-R-A-L, headspace. That's really what psychedelia is, that is then meted out in sonic tones. that's really the root of the psychedelic movement, that you are going to a place entrenched in you, and you're going to find a level of meaning that you're not going to find out in the quotidian world. And this is the song that does that. And it's a song that extols a goodly amount of courage, as we talked about, in doing that, which is the same thing that you're going to get with In My Life. It's 1965, here's the Beatles, they're doing Rubber Soul, and this man is singing this song about all these people he's loved, or maybe he didn't love, but he loves the memory, and he doesn't know some of them he does. It's a quite bittersweet song,
Yeah. Because
there's nothing to suggest that it's like in my rosy, super-duper happy life. You have to realize the Beatles themselves, and this is different than the narrators of their song, they were unhappy individuals at the height of their fame. It wasn't like this was fun. It might have looked fun, just like someone has a certain amount of Twitter followers and everyone assumes that's fun right now. But they were unhappy. They didn't get along. They lost their connection with each other. Bonds were broken. They had bad marriages. Lennon, I mean, like all of it. They lived these double lives. Their great friendship from before, like by the end, especially, they're really miserable people. They're just, despite the money, they're all like unhappy. And then I think it's notable that for like each of them, they were kind of done as Vanguard artist makers once they no longer knew each other. And people can mention Band on the Run or whatever they want, but their time, their lives peaked. Their artistic lives peaked when they were in their 20s.
No doubt.
They weren't even 30 yet, the oldest of them.
Ugh.
And so you have this song that introduces us to that burgeoning interiority in Bears a Place. And it's very closely related to In My Life. Mm. And then Strawberry Fields Forever goes a step further, where somebody says, look, I have this condition where my mind doesn't function like your mind does. And you can say that to people, one, when it's true, and two, when you're expressing it not as a boast, but almost as a kind of lament. There's a blues inflection to Strawberry Fields Forever, just as there is a blues inflection to the proto-psychedelia of There's a Place with the Bruce Chanel, Little Walter-type harmonica. So I think they're linked up that way. You could make, and I don't think it's a specious argument, you could make the argument that There's a Place as the first psychedelic rock and roll song.
Hmm. And how do you connect that to, because you even mentioned Pink Floyd when we were talking about how to make that connection for me.
That would be the early Pink Floyd, the Sybarite Pink Floyd, because he would have heard something like this and he would have been encouraged in his own interiority. If you listen to that first Floyd album or you listen to the Madcap Laughs, He's going to the same place that Lennon has suggested to people that they can go. He's not saying, oh, I was in love with this girl and it didn't work out because we didn't like the same kind of coffee. No, he's going to the internal vista. Hmm. The setting as such of that Pink Floyd album, the first one, and that first Sybarite album is going to be an internal setting. Now, I mean, it's like I have, for instance, I have a book called Dark March, and it's about heartbreak, and it's about a pain so great that a human can't endure it, can't house that pain. That pain comes out in different ways, and it's about how we continue on or we don't. So it's a book that anyone would look at and think, wow, this is a form of suffering that I think, because you have an extreme form of suffering and you think it's unique to you. Mm. You don't think anyone else has ever had that level of suffering. Whether it is or it isn't, doesn't really matter. That's how everybody feels. And then this book became something where it wasn't really set out in the world. It wasn't about like, oh, I'm going to the supermarket today, I'm sad. It had this interiority to it because that's where the intense emotion went. And you still had plots and stories and characters and everything, but they'd be animals. And then I had another book called Buried on the Beaches where all of it happens outside on Cape Cod in these towns, in these bars, in these clubs where people are making music. And it's the distinction between the two. The outside world and the interiority. So like Syd Barrett, There's a Place, Strawberry Fields Forever, they were more in line with the interiority of a book I did like Dark March. Whereas the other stuff, the I Want to Hold Your Hand, even though it's about love and unrequited love and this is how I'd like us to be seen in public. It's very much an outward expression. It's a way of moving out into the world rather than looking within, discovering what there is to be discovered there, mastering it, and then moving back out into the world, which is a huge difference. It's like a Socratic difference. You'd understand, like Plato, Aristotle, they'd be like, oh yeah, no, there's a place. That's the one that I'm like more apt to put on my Spotify than these other songs like Can't Buy Me Love.
Mm. That's an interesting way to put it too, because there and you obviously are listening through the lens of knowing the backstory on it, and knowing where they were heading as a band. So that's cool to be able to think like that. And what about like you even mentioned the Beach Boys song? What was it? In My Room? How that was similar in some ways to this?
Well, I don't think that knowing where they were going as a band. See, I always try to leave things compartmentalized. Like, if I hear Lennon singing in its first person, I never think it's Lennon. I never, whether it's Dylan, or I never think, oh, wow, Dylan, it's all right, Mom, only bleeding. I never think, like, that's about him. To me, it's always character. A character. And I think we have to be careful, even if it's not a character, you have to keep these things separate. Because if what I know about a band or the Beatles impacts how I hear what they are presenting to me as third-party autonomous art, then the art isn't working as it's supposed to work.
Yeah.
Right. Like, they're to me all sorts of... There's a lot of... And it's just the same way with, like, somebody can be a horrible person, right? I mean, look, John Lennon was a horrible, horrible person in many ways. Even Yoko Ono, he hit her. He did lots of things. Like, he cut his son out of his... Like, this was not... They made these Nazi salutes at the height of their fame in 1964 off balconies in New York. No one talks about it because people like the music, and also people are ignorant. Mm. Like, they just happen to see what's trending on Twitter and they know what to go after. But to me, it's always separate, because at the same time, you have to be a loving person to write something like In My Life.
Right.
You have to be a loving person to try to connect what you're doing with other people, and it's a form of help, really. I mean, the song Help itself is a form of help for people struggling with things, so I always try to keep that separate with them.
And I get what you're saying. I recently finished the book by his first wife, Cynthia Lennon. I don't know, have you read that?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, man. And it's like, at the end of the day, obviously you're hearing this from someone who has been very hurt by John Lennon.
Sure.
And I have to take that into account. But it made my stomach hurt, because it's like, gosh, I think so highly of him as a musician, and I have such a hard time reconciling that with other things, like you, some of the things you mentioned. And that's just hard. But like, you can't say there wasn't good in a person when you hear the beauty that they were able to create. It's just, that's hard. That's where the separating the art from the artist is interesting, because I can enjoy a painting by someone who is a terrible person and just enjoy the painting for the painting's sake. But it gets into an interesting space when the true things, or when the stories of the artist, start creeping into the art. Like you said, it brings other things into play instead of just judging the thing that was created.
I think an artist is two entities. An artist is a person, and more so than that, they are the art. There is truth to the whole live forever thing. Other people, the average life is whatever it's going to be, 74 years, I don't even know. But the artist, it's a twofold existence. And I think when you are that advanced, especially too, compared to other people, it's hard. Being in the world. It's not being a member of the meaty part of the curve. It's being out there alone. Maybe you find somebody not at your level, but like at a level where you're not going down too far. But we can play that game with, I mean, I joke about it in the blog, but seriously, anyone give me a name. Anyone you've ever, Picasso, Beethoven, Gogol, anyone you've like ever liked, anyone at all, because I know my job to know these things are part of my job. You can do this with everybody. I mean, anyone, Paul McCartney, anyone at all, no matter how they might look at a certain point in history, because that's just how, that's how humans are.
Yeah.
It's not what we do now where it's like all good, all bad. I mean, like, I was thinking about this the other day. I'm writing about Ella Fitzgerald, actually, today. And I was thinking that it's such an amazing concept now. Like, you'd be stoned for it. But there are racists out there who are good people, by and large. And there are people who aren't racist at all who are horrible people.
Yeah.
Because, like, maybe you, like, have this grandmother, and she has these beliefs, but she's at the soup kitchen. She's done all these wonderful things throughout her life and was this person of selfless love. But that's just how people are. And I think that the Beatles, at least, and I'll give Lennon credit for this, the thing that you said, Cynthia Lennon, Two Sides to Every Story, he was pretty open after about the man he was and the choices he made and the way that he impacted lives. He didn't shy away from that. But when you read about something, how she comes home and he's in the bathrobe with Yoko Ono and he's just so cold. Like, I mean, it's the type of thing when you're reading it, it's the beginning too of the book, The Love You Make. Mm-hmm. And you read that and it's like, it's hard to keep reading. Like, you're going to read on.
Yeah.
But you're going to put the book down and maybe go out like for a walk and a coffee. Like, you're going to clear your head because it's just uncomfortable. And I first read that when I was 14. And one of the thoughts I was thinking was like, this is like what adulthood? I'm not so keen on this. I would not have. Is this how people are? And not only are people often like that with each other, but they're often worse. But he was just so dispassionate. This man rammed with so much passion. And it's what happened. And it's you listen to There's a Place. And I've always been able to do it. I've always been able to hear the music, the book, the painting, whatever it is. I've been able to experience those things completely separately. And I think you have to.
I think you have to as well. I mean, I think you have to. And the last thing I want to hit on was, like, let's talk about the time frame here. It's February 1963. The Beatles are recording their first album. 4 years later, February 1967, they're recording A Day in the Life. They're recording Sgt. Pepper. I can't even wrap my head around the artistic jump of start to peak in a 4 year span. When you look at bands now that might wait 4 years between albums, just cause, you know, just talk about them compared to any other artist as far as the growth between those two moments. I mean, does that astound you? It blew me away when I looked it up. I was like, 4 years? That's nuts to me.
It doesn't astound me really, because it's a logical progression when you follow through the actual recordings. And when you look at someone like, I mean, look at Bach, look at Miles Davis, look at anyone who was imbued with talent or genius, who you have to chop the wood every day.
Yeah.
And when you chop the wood every day and you already have the genius, you get better, you get faster. Now, that doesn't mean that your work is in itself better. It means that the process for you to reach that qualitative endpoint is an easier process for you. But when you put, we're in a society now where we don't, like in my business, for instance, someone might write something once every like 8 years and it sucks. And they workshop it with their friends. I mean, what time did we hopped on at 11:30 your time today? I'd already written two short stories and put up a blog. I mean, that's, when you have the ability and you put the time and you chop the wood, you progress. In fact, so you can find other people like the Beatles who progressed. 4 years in Beatles time, that was like 250 years in somebody else's time.
To me,
that was, they mastered that element of time, that schism of external time and internal time. Now, everyone you know, right? Everyone in our world right now thinks they're three things. They think they're smart, they think they're funny, they think they're busy. And they're going to tell you those three things. They're normally, at best, one for three. And they're almost never busy. But really, how many people, you're like, I'm not that busy. It's like, I kind of just like, I'm having a Pop-Tart. Like, people don't really talk that way, right?
That's true.
Everyone, no matter how unbusy they are, but you never hear people who are actually busy say, I'm not going to get this done. I'm in trouble. This is not going to go well. And the Beatles never talked about being busy. They simply went out and got it done. And as they got it done more and more, they got faster. And their ideas came to them quicker. So you make this leap because you can see we've shown people, we've delineated the progression. It's quite logical, really, between there's a place, the second side of A Hard Day's Night, Help, In My Life, Strawberry Fields Forever, from the autumn of 1966. It actually begun that summer when Lennon was in Spain, to, as you mentioned, February 67, the band's collective high water mark with A Day in the Life. There is that delineated process right there. We can see it. That's what happened. And in that lacuna space, and all of that in-betweenness, they worked and they got better and they challenged each other and they were challenged by other people competing against them. And they never said, oh no, give us a performance trophy. This is getting too intense. They went for it. And also part of going for it is challenging yourself. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wrote 5 stories last week. I think any of them could be around forever. And so I get up in this new week and I think, oh, that was last week. Maybe you suck now. Mm. Prove it to me again. Right. And I drop 2, because that's sort of that's the mind frame that someone like that has. And that was an era when it was a great time to have that frame of mind, because there was that meritocracy element.
And it made for better art that we're still talking about all these years later. So, man, I love talking about this. Colin, thank you so much for joining us today. You guys can look for his book, Same Band You've Never Known, An Alternative Musical History of the Beatles. He's putting it together now. I can't wait to have it when it's out. And looking forward to talking about the Beatles with Colin over the next several episodes of the podcast. So, Colin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Leave a rating and review so others can find the podcast as well.